being demanding little people. Put it politely.
Aren't we all demanding little people, Mike?
Well, we eventually become demanding big people, but there are other adults we interact with who normally don't give us our way. That is the lesson of adulthood, actually.
I love that you're just...
My parents are going to be here to let me have everything that I want.
I like that you're just openly trolling me in your columns now with the fab column.
Yeah, it's where we're headed.
See, whenever I hear that Run DMC song, I think of that scene in White Chicks.
I know the movie, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, well, they break dance in the club to that song.
Okay.
They're like spinning around upside down. It's the best.
Yeah, I'm familiar with what you're talking about. I mean, I've seen the clip of that. I've just never seen the movie. And I didn't even know that was the song they were dancing to, but I've seen the whole spinning around thing. So, yeah, I know.
Anyway. Eric
Flaherty in to make things interesting for the Mets. I'm sure Blackman's going to hit a home run for us here, Brett.
Yeah, he might. O'Flaherty's fucking terrible.
He's been bad so far, yeah.
He's not good. He's not good.
No.
You know who's killed me this year? Corey Dickerson, just like being injured the entire year. That was real helpful to every team I have him on.
Yeah.
I just have the only expert who had Blackman ahead of Dickerson, if I remember correctly.
I mean, you can't predict injuries, can you? Like,
no, I had Blackman ahead of him because of the steals. I didn't think he was going to steal this much. I thought regardless of what he did, he was going to steal like 25 to 30.
Right.
Yeah, but Dickerson, that undersells how good Dickerson is. Dickerson is fantastic.
Yes.
I just thought from a straight up value proposition that he was gonna beat him. Barring a miracle here, Cargo is not gonna home run tonight or hit a home run.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's a crazy world.
He's had what 20 this month or something? I'm not kidding.
I think it's 18 like, in his last 26 games.
Yeah,
it's some insane number.
It's batshit crazy.
Schwarber's first at bat tonight, he like missed the ball and he still hit it like 395 feet and like it almost went out.
Yeah, he's unseasonably strong.
He's a beast. Uh-huh. Like he got under this ball and I thought it was going to just be like a lazy fly ball and he hit it all like pretty much to the edge of the track.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance that he's going to be my number one fantasy catcher in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, this is hyperbole, but he's going to be like a slightly poor man's Piazza, I think.
Yeah, with the possibility of being slightly better.
That maybe. Whole lineup is scary.
That's where I just want to be careful. Well, I think for contextually for across eras, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's gonna be weird. I think we're gonna have some new guys be like top options at positions in redraft leagues next year. It's gonna be really fun.
I wrote about it with Correa. It's like isn't he a top five guy? Like just by the position alone.
I think Correa might be a second round pick next year.
Well, the funny thing is, given the position. Like in a 15-team league, like back of the first, you know, end of the first, beginning of the second, I don't think it's too radical.
It's different in a redraft because you can make the track record argument that, you know, I'd rather have Miguel Cabrera because I've seen him do it for a decade.
Yeah, but in a
dynasty, it's like
Cabrera's going to go in the middle of the first round. Like my thing about Correa is like, you know, Brett and I took Tulo and Desmond like, you know, 15 and 16. Is there an argument at this point against taking Correa like a little bit past that? Like I don't think there is.
Well, he's certainly past Desmond. I think he might have Desmond's passed gonna slip Tulo also.
Right. Well, that was so I was on somebody's podcast and he was asking me that and it, you know, he was surprised that I said like mid second, early second. And I'm like, well, you know, you have to consider the position. Like it's not just how good Correa is, it's that even if he regressed a little bit next year, which he will, you're still looking at a guy who can hit like 25 to 30 home runs at shortstop.
That's crazy.
And still 20 bases.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a good discussion.
Yeah, we should maybe save this, because I wrote about it, I mean, but I had a, there's like a really insane stat about the 2020 shortstops. It's like, basically nobody does that.
Not anymore, no.
Right.
Are we recording this or no?
Yeah, I'm recording it.
Oh, this should just be the podcast.
Flags Fly Forever, unfiltered.
Yeah, this is like that extra special episode of that TV show where they start with the plot and then like 10 minutes in they go to the opening credits just out of nowhere. So good evening, and welcome to episode 64 of Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Perspectives Fantasy Podcast. You've been listening to a lot of talking so far, and we're going to keep talking because we're enjoying our conversation, and hopefully it's somewhat helpful. It's fantasy related, and we're having fun. So you are listening to all your usual suspects. I am Brett Sayer, your host. You're listening to Mike Gianella and George Bissell. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. It's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. It's two S's and two L's. Read us at baseballperspectives.com. So where were we? George, you were talking about 2020 shortstops, were you not?
Yeah, basically since 2005, so over the last decade, the number of guys who have hit 20 home runs and stolen 20 bases in a single season are Hanley Ramirez, who did it an astounding 5 times, Jimmy Rollins, who did it 4 times, Ian Desmond 3 times each of the last 3 years, although he's unlikely to do it again this year, and then Troy Tulowitzki did it once. So Carlos Correa, we're basically looking at a guy who has legitimate 2020 potential. He's only 20 years old. He'll be 21 next season. And according to Mike's valuations, I mean, if he had played the full year to this point in the year, he'd be on track to earn $42 in AL-only leagues.
Assuming he did what he's done so far prorated back to April, which, you know, right. There's all sorts of caveats with that. Yeah, it's still pretty impressive.
Even baking in a little bit of regression, I mean, that's still a first-round guy in terms of value.
Some regression, that's like a $35 season, and that's still incredible.
And the only really knock we have on Correa is that we just haven't seen him do it for a full year. So it's hard to knock him for that, because you could have said the same thing about Mike Trout. And well, I know that's sort of the exception, but when you look at the pedigree and sort of who we thought Correa was as a prospect, it's not all that surprising that this is the kind of guy he is it, Brett?
No, I mean, you get these guys take different, these guys take all kinds of different shapes, but you know, we've seen this before. This isn't completely, it's unusual, but it's not completely unwarranted. And it's usually players who it's usually players who are college guys, players who hitters who, you know, sort of have that advanced, you know, tag to them. You know, I'm talking about they're really only a handful of examples. You have guys like Ryan Braun. Albert Pujols is the extreme example, but you know, think back to what Ryan Braun did in his rookie season. So he came up in, I think he came up in mid-May. I don't know the game logs of 2007. And hit .324 with 34 home runs. And he also stole 15 bases. He played in 113 games. So, you know, what Correa has done is fantastic. I don't know what Braun would have, what Braun earned in that season, but I imagine his prorated season is slightly better than what we've seen from Correa, even with the positional adjustment. What was that?
What year?
2007.
might have that, but it'll take me time.
But the bigger thing here is that he plays shortstop. I mean, the added value of that is so great. Because if he were just an outfielder, we're not having this conversation. But the fact that he's so much better than pretty much every shortstop not named Tulowitzki at this point is got to factor into your decision making. It's different in a redraft league because, like I was saying, I mean, you can make the argument based on track record that, you know, guys like Goldschmidt, Abreu, Cruz, you know, those types of guys, McCutchen, Josh Donaldson, you know, those types of guys have done it for a longer period of time, so you can sort of make the argument for them over Correa. But you win fantasy leagues by making bold decisions. I think Correa is talented enough that I would take the shot on him in the first round. I have no problem doing that.
The thing that's interesting, though, about that premise about redraft leagues, George, is I think you're right. But there is a point. Like, you know, I think about like the strategy or one of the strategies that Brett and I employed in labor this year where we've been more successful so far than we were in 2014 is kind of finding the guys that have experience, but peak experience. With the exception of Albert Pujols, we kind of were in the sweet spot of 25 to 32-year-old hitters as opposed to some of the older guys that brought us down in 2014. So guys like Cruz, guys like Pujols are examples where I might actually discount them a little bit next year just because of some age-related regression. And like you're saying, you know, bump Correa up, not crazily. Like, I don't want to assume this year is the new normal and you know, put him, you know, in the middle of the first round. But if you're looking at the back of the first round in a 15-teamer, I'm pretty comfortable with that. And some of this is just the product of he's obviously not Mike Trout. He's as a player, as an all-around player. But as a fantasy proposition, based on what he's done at his age, he's fairly close, which is saying something.
Yeah, yeah. The question becomes, and this is something that we've, you know, I think we talked about this in the preseason, is when you have a guy like Correa and you're thinking about making him your first pick, if you're picking the end of the first round in a redraft next year, and you're thinking about it, you know, the thing that comes into my head is that, you know, there's the old adage that you can't win your fantasy league in the first round, but you can lose the fantasy league in the first round. It's overused and it's over exaggerated at times, but there is an element of truth to it. And you know, it's in those situations where you're likely to take towards the end of the first round, you're likely to take a couple more chances. But if you're talking about sneaking up into the top 10, I think that's probably unlikely, even if he continues this in redraft leagues.
But I you know, my question is, you know, this kind of goes back, and this isn't to knock us on Ian Desmond, but, you know, in retrospect, and this ties into your point, Brett, we took Desmond at 16th overall in labor. I'd almost rather have the upside at that pick of a Correa than a Desmond who, you know, honestly, even if he did what we expected him to do and go 20-20 with a low batting average, I think I want a Correa there with the upside with the downside similar to Desmond's, you know, upside this year at the beginning of the year every time.
I don't know if that's such a fair example just because, I mean, Desmond was coming off three straight 2020 years.
Well, Desmond shit the bet. I mean, I get it.
Yeah, he did. But you know, it's I know some people have been calling for Ian Desmond regression for 3 years, and you know, even if you called for it, I don't think anyone quite saw this year coming. Even though he's been better of late, but you know, obviously that's. It's all relative. Everything's relative.
There was a great piece. I think it was Ron Chandler who wrote it after Mike Trout's insane sort of rookie year. At the year after the debut where he hit like 195 or something like that. The next season when he played the full year and put up the monster stats. he talked about how it was such an extreme outlier, and anyone who sort of paid for that again was making a mistake. And then Trout went out and was the number one player again the next year.
George, you might be too young to remember, but that was my first column at Baseball Prospectus back in 2013. I examined that premise and essentially rejected it because, and this ties nicely to our conversation, because Trout is was the outlier of outliers. You know, he was just somebody who was so special that he was the best player at his age. You know, I use a very simple construct, you know, by Baseball References, you know, a metric, you know, in terms of adjusted OPS, he was the best player of his age, like, ever.
Well, that's
and the odds of him slipping to me, it's kind of like, okay, well, if Mike Trout slips, he's still a $30 player. You know, he's still somebody who's going to be, you know, a top 15, top 20 guy.
Right. I don't think Correa is Mike Trout or anything like that.
No, I don't want to give that impression at all.
Yeah, but I agree completely with you guys. He's in the conversation for that back half of the first round. You know, if he slides to the second, you know, absolutely pull the trigger. So I just think it's such a fun conversation because we have such an extreme sample size here in terms of how small it is and how good it is and how freakishly talented Correa is in his age that he's so much fun to talk about. I could do it for an hour. Well, yeah, he's that kind of guy.
To bring this to a broader point, what I think is going to be interesting about this offseason, we've talked a lot about how this is kind of the year of the rookie or the year of the rookie coming through in a big way and emerging and breaking out. You know, we're talking about Kyle Schwarber a little bit, who has looked great so far. It is where Chris Bryant's another good example. It's where you value these rookies, and that's what I'm going to be really intrigued by. I think a lot of these guys are legitimate. It's just a question of where do you draft them or where do you put your auction price, because there is, and this is the point I think we're all trying to get to, there is a floor with these guys, and while the floor might be higher because of what they've done to date, they're still going to be sophomores next year. They're still going to have that, I hate this word, but they're still going to have that regression that you have to kind of consider when you're drafting or when you're building an auction price.
Yeah, and there's going to be so many fun auction dynamics in play next year because, you know, we all know there are owners in every league that are excited to draft rookies with upside or second-year players with upside and owners that are hesitant to do so. And there's such a thick crop of players who have demonstrated the ability to perform at the major league level but don't have, scare quote, proven track records, that you're going to have you're going to have too many of those players for those types of owners, or at least there's going to be an imbalance to what we've seen before. So we're going to get, you know, we're talking about guys that are at the top of the, you know, sort of mind-blowing list, but, you know, you move down a notch to guys who would be that in almost any other year. Take like Miguel Sano, for example. Sano has been pretty great since he's been up. But he's getting completely overshadowed by all of these other rookies. And, you know, whereas there's usually such a premium that you have to pay for these guys, given the, you know, the shininess of them and given their upside, that there are going to be some values in those auctions if you let them come to you, because you don't know which players those are going to be. You know, it could be Chris Bryant, it could be Miguel Sano, it could be Byron Buxton, it could be really anybody. And I think that's going to be one of the more fascinating things to track when we get ready for auctions.
Yeah, and I think that dynamic will play out a little bit more in mixed and deeper mixed leagues. I think in mono leagues, those players will be valued more appropriately just based on their role and playing time.
Brett, sure, I'd be interested in what you think of Byron Buxton, because that's kind of a conversation now. I mean, looking at how well Correa's played, I mean, you had Buxton ranked ahead of Correa in the preseason. It looks like he's going to get an opportunity the rest of this season maybe, but definitely next year. I mean, should we be focusing more on guys like that? When you're talking about sort of the value that there's so many guys who have put up numbers, he's a guy who we all thought was going to be even maybe better than a guy like Correa. Are those the types of guys you should sort of be targeting? Not necessarily like Javier Baez, but, you know, guys like that who haven't necessarily put up huge numbers but still have that prospect pedigree.
No, but that's the thing, right? And you hit it on the head. And to be perfectly honest, I will target the shit out of Javier Baez next year, because that's where the value is. And we had that conversation before the season about that's not where the value was for Baez this year. But we've all seen this before. Baez is going to be undervalued in auctions next year. He'll creep up as the season goes along if it looks like he's going to get some playing time. But he's the kind of guy, and he's the kind of guy who's lost enough shine.
There's a term for this. It's called post-hype sleeper, and it's not a term that we invented. It's an old term. And that's what Baez is. He's a post-hype sleeper. He's somebody who's going to probably be undervalued because he was a disappointment this year, even though there's so much talent there. I think that the trick with a lot of this, to me, Baez, and, you know, before you came on, George, me, Brett, and Mao had a long discussion. It was mainly me and Brett about Javi Baez. And Brett was kind of trying to talk me off the ledge of being down on Baez. And somebody I liked, and we had this discussion, you know, via email with J.P. Breen, and I'm not just saying this to pat myself on the back. Somebody I liked was Brandon Crawford. And I said Crawford was going to have a better year than Baez. And I didn't think Crawford would do what he's done this year. But I looked at his baseline of performance, and I was like, you know what? He hit lefties in 2014, which he hasn't done before. He's kind of a solid guy. He could hit a few more home runs if he continues to hit lefties, which he has done. I pegged him for 15 to 17 maybe on the season. You know, I didn't think he'd be doing what he's doing. But that's where this conversation's interesting. It's like, okay, a lot of these rookies are really good, and a lot of these second-tier guys like Buxton and Baez are should be valued appropriately. But does, and I think you're getting at this too, Brett, you know, does this create an opportunity the other way with some of these veterans in leagues where someone like, say, a Chris Liss of RotoWire, like, really values the rookies and pushes them up way high, where you can get that opportunity on a veteran? And I think that's where the dynamic next year is more fascinating than I've seen it in years.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not sure what the answer is on that, because you have, you know, you have all these different types of owners. You have your owners that are going to go value-based and are going to end up with veterans, and I think those guys aren't going to push on these rookies anyway. So I don't know how much the veteran market is really going to be affected by this, and I don't, you know, we don't know until it starts, but I wonder whether it's going to get affected at all.
Yep, we're just kind of at that point in the season where it's kind of fun to look ahead to next year and sort of some of the dynamics of these values for players next year. It's a lot of fun to do.
Let me ask you, Bright. So, you know, we've been, you know, and I see this in Tout Wars, and, you know, I bring up the expert leagues just because you can go out and look at them and follow them. So, you know, I've been in Tout Wars NL. This is my sixth year. And part of the reason I've had more success this year, so far at least, than I have in the past, it is because I've studied some of the tendencies of the other owners. And, you know, you kind of see, like, for example, you know, Lenny Melnick of Roto Experts doesn't pay for saves. And, you know, Todd Zola of Masters Ball goes and gets his guy. So do you feel, being in labor for 2 years, that kind of seeing some of those tendencies and, you know, honestly seeing people like talk on Twitter about what they like to do or don't like to do is an advantage?
I think it's a very mild advantage. In a draft, there's really only so much you can glean from that, just because it's, you know, it's the combination of knowing the strategy and just who happens to be on the board at the time. In an auction, absolutely. In an auction, that is essential. You really can't underestimate the importance of knowing the people that you're playing with while you are doing an auction. But for a draft, I don't know how much it really matters. I mean, people who might have been familiar with what we wanted to do going into labor this year, I don't know that they would have been able to predict anything that we did. I don't know how. We didn't predict all that well what we were going to do. It just happened.
Well, that's true. Although I guess I'm thinking of examples, and I think this is true whether it's auction or draft. The way I would, and I think you're right, Brett. I think in a draft it's hard because of that wiper idea, and because you can't go out in theory like do what I didn't tout and buy Goldschmidt and Kershaw. You're limited, in the types of players you can get depending on where your slot is. But I do think in some of the later rounds, like I'm thinking of Jake Seeley, for example. He's a good example of someone, and I believe he's also Roto Experts, if memory serves. He's very risk reward, and his team was built that way, and his team is crash and burn. And this isn't a criticism because I've certainly seen teams like that finish toward the top. But seeing his, I'm bringing something more to see how his draft played out, knowing that. To me, and knowing there's a couple owners like that, and this kind of ties into our rookie conversation, I think can give you a slight, I don't want to say advantage, but a slight knowledge base when you're kind of drafting to think, well, okay, like there's somebody that might be there later. And for the position we were in on the wiper, it doesn't help. I'm thinking more like if you're in the middle of a draft or in the middle rounds or mid-pick.
Yeah, where it really helps is when you're just off the end, and you're maybe within two or three picks of the end, and you know what some of the tendencies of those owners are. Like, but if you have the 13th pick, and there are two teams picking two guys ahead of you, most every other round, knowing what those owners are going to do is immensely helpful, but. It's really just a matter of where you are, because you can have all that information and you can use it to your advantage a little bit, but most of the time it just won't matter.
Well, it's funny because I got into a long, I don't know if either one of you saw this, I got into a long discussion with, I don't know if it was Gray or Rudy. I think it was Rudy Gamble of Razzball. And if it was Gray and you're listening, I apologize, but. We got into a long discussion about labor, and this tied into the, should you take pitching early, should you take pitching late discussion. It's talking about, we made this point about Kershaw. We've made this point about Kershaw a number of times, which is you don't have to take pitching early. And I was using where we got, Gerrit Cole, Jake Arrieta, and Jacob deGrom as like, look, you can get these guys late. And the Razzball point was like, well, you guys kind of got lucky. It's like, well, that's not really the point. And I wasn't bringing this up to take a preliminary victory lap of what we did in labor, but that's three guys that went well past where you take an ace, who have delivered ace value. And I think some of it to kind of get back to what you're saying, Brett, it's not so much knowing the tendencies of others, but just kind of playing your draft and playing to your value. And I think something we do that's different is we probably have, the last couple of years, have played the best value off the board in the first, I'd say, 10 to 12 rounds, and then start to look at categories or positions. Whereas I think a lot of people, after the first three or four rounds, really start to look at positions and as opposed to value.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, I imagine we probably were, if a team was trying to kind of gauge what we were doing when we were on the wiper and labor, that was probably not a very fun task. Just because I think we kind of, well, we did what I think people would expect from us, which is to take all the players who we consider to be the best players on our board. And that in itself is not, when your strategy is to take the best available player on your board, it's really hard to predict that unless you have those persons' rankings in front of you. Right. But even then, I mean, that it's
something about that works for me, whether it's a draft or an auction, is that I think about, I'm in the CBS Expert League, which is a kind of a lesser expert league compared to some of, to labor and tout. But there was one year, it's an auction. I typically buy players later because the prices are crazy. And I typically buy more pitching in those leagues because the pitching prices are low. So there's one year I bought a bunch of hitters early and I didn't spend much on pitching. And midway through another expert, I don't remember who it was like years ago, was like, he said this in the chat. He's like, you're not supposed to do that. Every year you buy a lot of pitching and you spend late. And that's something I love to hear. It's sort of the – and I think Jeff Quinton talked about this in one of his recent pieces. It's the game theory idea. It's the idea that you're supposed to throw people off a little bit with what you do. If you do the same thing year in and year out, whether it's a draft or an auction, at some point people are going to have you pegged. And they're like, all right, well, you know, Mike and Brett, it's eight rounds. They take a closer like somewhere between the ninth and the 11th. I know they're going to take a closer at some point, so that can influence my picks. Whereas if they don't know that we're going to do that, like next year in labor, I would love to take a closer early, not because I believe in the strategy, but just because we haven't done that the last 2 years, and I'd love to throw people that curveball.
Please don't let us take a closer early in labor. Well,
can it be Chapman?
Okay. It can be Chapman.
Ken Giles.
We talked about too. He was on the table. In that three, four.
Cody Allen or Melanson that had he not been taken, like two or three picks before our pick, we would have taken him.
It was Melanson. It was Melanson before we went pitcher.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to what you're talking about, which is I think people might look back at these drafts and think, oh, like Mike and Brett were going to flood pitching with Arrieta, Cole, and DeGrom, and it worked out, but it might not have worked out. But it's like, no, they were just the value guys there.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right.
Well, I'm trying to think back. In the first 10 to 12 rounds of labor, was there a pick that we turned away that Nelson Cruz is a guy I think I liked more than you did that we were on the fence about, but was still behind on our values to Adam Wainwright? And there was somebody else like that. It was Johnny Cueto we were debating. He was also a little bit behind where we were on our values. But I don't think there was a guy we turned away in those early rounds. We had a debate about Charlie Blackmon, but I won that debate. But there wasn't really – we had a mild debate about Wainwright that
– Yeah, I was going to say that Upton pick, the way we went with the two picks there where you got Upton. I feel like there was another guy you were considering. I feel like it was like Carlos Gonzalez or someone like that.
Well, the thing about
we had Carlos Gonzalez pegged as a guy who might fall to us. I think he went three or four picks before that turn.
The thing about Upton though is that we weren't even necessarily that high in him. His ADP I think was in the like mid 30s and we got him at 45.
I think his ADP was 31 or 32. There was no way he should have made it to us. That's the thing.
There was no way
Upton should have made it to us, and there was no way Garrett Cole should have made it to us. Well, so
all the way back to what we were talking about, especially with Upton, and this, it's so funny, this goes in circles. So what happens a lot is you get these upside picks and people taking rookies or second year players, and you know, Mike Potterzer of Fangraphs took Billy Hamilton early and he took Mookie Betts early and he had a certain strategy. So when you have a lot of these upside picks, you get a guy like Upton sitting there at 45 that who everyone's like, yeah, you know, he's not exciting, he's boring. It's like, well, yes, but his floor is high. And you know what he's going to do. And we didn't expect him to steal as much as he did in the early going. But even without those steals, like, for example, in NL only, I think 22 or 23 has been his floor the last 4 or 5 years. The guy earns even in the years that he's disappointing.
Yep.
Yeah. It's and the fact that I find it amusing that Upton is thought of as more of a boring guy now, just because it's easy to, you know, to look at him and be like, oh sure, he's, you know, not 23 anymore, he's, you know, he doesn't have a chance of being one of the top players in fantasy, but he does. He's
we have a team of those, but we have a team of those guys. We have a team that. Really, and especially on the hitting side, you know, if you look at our hitters, we have a team of players that coming into the year we're just kind of boring.
Yeah, and some of them for real reasons, and some of them because we hadn't seen the real versions of them yet, or because we thought there were better versions of them around. But
I agree, although I think some of that is that some of these players, you know, Dexter Fowler is a good example, and I think Curtis Granderson is a good example. They're performing better than, you know, people thought they would. But even if they had performed similar to the way they did the year before, and we got them on another turn as well, they still provide a certain amount of value where at that point in the, you know, in the draft, people are I saw this everywhere. It was a mock or a draft or a league that played out. People in the 15th, 16th round start taking guys who are upside guys or nothing but upside guys. And the thing about those upside picks is you can get a lot of those upside picks much later. And I'm not saying never to make an upside pick in the 16th round, but there's so many experts that's all they're focused on at that point. And, you know, it's kind of like betting, you know, red 32 or black 32 on roulette. It's like, well, you might hit it, but chances are good that you won't.
We actually talked about a great example of this earlier. I'm thinking of two guys, TJ House and Shane Green, where they got all this buzz and everyone had to have them in the late rounds. And it's like, if you burned a pick on one of those guys instead of, I don't know if Dexter Fowler, if his ADP is even, you know, comparable. Brandon Crawford, a great example, like someone you knew was going to have an everyday job and was a good hitter. That would have been a much better investment than speculating wildly on a pitcher.
Well, at that point, you know, it's funny because, you know, that those are really good examples on the pitching side. And with pitchers, like, you know, we took Noah Syndergaard and Andrew Haney like really late in the reserve round. And you see that with pitchers. You see people taking spec plays like in the 10th, the 11th, the 12th round. And I'm not necessarily saying to take the boring middle of the road guy either, because those guys don't necessarily work out. But there's so much variability with pitching on the back end that there's no need to, like, Green's a great example. There's no need to make that sexy play that early, especially with his peripherals. It just didn't, even if Green hit his ceiling, it didn't seem like he was going to, you know, return the value that he was, you know, going for, particularly in some of these early drafts.
No, and you have, and this goes back to another thing we were talking about before, you know, those picks, Syndergaard and Heaney, there are reasons why they were available in the reserve round. And it's not because they don't have upside. It's because it's all recency bias. I mean, Syndergaard spent all of 2014 in Las Vegas. And frankly, he was disappointing in Las Vegas. And people thought he was going to be up in the majors in 2014. He wasn't. There was a little bit of burnout with Syndergaard and how people were valuing him. I think, you know, I don't know whether he was drafted in labor in 2014, but I wonder whether he was drafted in a similar spot that year. And, you know, you see that with these guys, Heaney as well. Heaney was, you know, pretty good in the minors, but got a, got a taste of the majors and wasn't very good.
Heaney's probably an even better example because he had those starts in the majors. You know, I remember, like, he was another guy I debated where it's like, look, maybe he's not going to be the ace or the number two that people thought he was going to be, but he should be a three, and, you know, he's pitching, you know, in a park and for a team that is going to forgive some mistakes.
Brett, a good example of what you're talking about for next year, I think, is like Corey Seager, a guy who everybody thought was going to get a shot this year and never did, and there are going to be questions as to why, and he's a guy who will go pretty late in drafts next year that, you know, could have a huge impact.
Yeah, and there's guys like that. There's guys like that every year, and you know, there are reasons for all of them. But, you know, we as a whole, the industry, as in, you know, but the baseball writing industry and Major League Baseball as well, people have gotten better at identifying talent in the minor leagues, and I sometimes think that hasn't quite caught up in fantasy yet, because we have, you know, we have these extensive minor league histories on these guys like Syndergaard and Heaney, and you know, as soon as there's a reason to doubt them, as soon as there's some struggles, people start jumping off the bandwagon. And, you know, especially for a guy like Heaney, who had, what, 4 or 5 starts at the major league level and was not good.
He had like a 7 ERA.
Yeah, he was not good. But we had 3 years of evaluation on Heaney before he made those five starts.
Well,
how much are you really going to put stock in those five starts?
Yeah.
And the difference between Heaney and someone like Archie Bradley is that, you know, with Bradley there were some flags with his starts in terms of, you know, lower velocity or you know, not poor location. With Heaney, it really seemed like a small sample size. It's like, well, he's not doing well, but it's not based on anything I can see in the performance markers of velocity. He's just not doing well.
I think Brett hit the nail on the head, though. We have a better understanding of the value of that sample size in the minor leagues and what it means and sort of how a player's, you know, relative upside or the complete picture of who a player is. I think we have a better understanding of that now than we ever did before. So if you're overrating a small sample, whether it's at the major leagues or at the minor league level, I think you're making a mistake is sort of the greater point. And if we can keep that in mind to look at the bigger picture instead of what's just happened, you know, factoring in recency bias again, but trying to avoid that and looking at a player's complete profile, it'll help you make better draft decisions.
I think I completely agree, and you know, this has kind of been my life's work in this has been trying to determine valuation in fantasy. One of the challenges that I have is I'm not as prospect heavy, but one of the challenges I think the industry has, you know, it's what at a job I had we used to call the Groundhog Day phenomenon. We're having this great conversation right now in mid-August or early August about this. And all this is terrific. But you know what's going to happen in the industry as a whole? And it's already happening. Everybody's going to start talking about fantasy football. A lot of these experts that I've mentioned on the show do fantasy football. And I'm not taking away from their baseball acumen. They're all really good at what they do. But February is going to roll around, and a lot of this is going to be forgotten. And people are going to make a lot of the same mistakes that they make because of this.
That's completely right. And you know, this happens really, really anywhere. You know, if you are out riding a bike for 6 months and then you put the bike away and start, you know, riding a skateboard for the next 4 months, you're going to be a little bit wobbly on the bike when you get back up.
The experts that jump to mind as being really good at this. You know, and I'll mention some names. And again, the ones that do football are good at this too. But the experts that are really good at this, Fred Zinke of MLB.com, Steve Gardner of USA Today, we've joked about before, Tristan Cockcroft of ESPN, Larry Schechter of Winning Fantasy Baseball. Do you know why, you know, Mike Podhurst of Fangraphs, what do they all have in common? They're either baseball only, or if they do football like Tristan and Steve do, it's secondary, and it's really secondary. I mean, these guys breathe it, and you know, unlike Brett and I, who have like 9-to-5 jobs, they do it for a living.
They also do all their own valuations. That's another thing. I think most of those guys, whether it's Larry or Mike or
Steve, uses HQ. But yeah, I mean, if they don't do their own valuations, they certainly pour over the valuations that they get.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think this has been a fun conversation. We kind of got lost in this, huh?
I think it's good stuff that people are going to be able to apply, whether it's, you know, a home league, any league that you play in. I think it has definite value. Do we want to do any of the fab bidding for the expert leagues, or just kind of run through it, or
do we want to do fab, or do we want to talk about the trade deadline? Because I know at one point this is going to be the trade deadline show.
Yeah, I think. Let's do the short version of the fab, just because I don't think there's a whole ton to talk about. But let's do the short version and then talk about the trade deadline.
Okay, let's. If you don't mind, then why don't we start with the National League in tout, just because I kind of have that on the brain.
Okay,
as opposed to the Knicks. So. There was a trade this week, which, you know, if you play in a shallow mixed league, barely registered. But if you play in an only or a deeper mixed, would have registered. It was the trade with the Indians and the Braves. And Michael Bourne and Nick Swisher went to the Braves. Chris Johnson went to the Indians, and so in town NL there was a bit of a mini bidding war with the players, you know, with Bourne and Swisher. And Brian Walton, who had been fourth in Fab before the trade deadline, wound up getting Bourne, and Gene McCaffrey, who had been fifth in Fab, wound up getting Swisher. But both teams kind of played this appropriately. I think that Brian, you know, in his position, he can kind of jump a little bit in steals, and he's solid on offense. So Bourne was the right play. I know he hasn't done much this year, but he could, you know, maybe there could be a revitalization. And Gene is dead all the way across the board, but he's especially dead in steals. So Swisher to him is the right play. Now, these are guys that they're not necessarily going to be big impact guys. But it's August, you know, it's August 11th as I'm talking here on Tuesday night. It was August 9th when they bid. You're at a point where maybe somebody else big comes in from the American League, but maybe they don't. And both those teams are looking to kind of get over the 60-point threshold where they don't get penalized for Fab next year. So I think both those plays were solid.
Yeah, I agree. It was a really interesting trade in general. But I want to talk about Bourne just for a second. Where he's been a guy who really just kind of has completely fallen out of the at least have fallen out of the mixed league fantasy universe. Are we going to see Michael Bourne legitimate, you know, if not shallow mixed starting outfielder, but, you know, medium sized mixed league starting outfielder ever again?
Are you asking me or George?
Well, the speed's just not there. I mean, if you just look at the decline across the board over, what is it now, 3 or 4 years of steady decline, pretty much. He's not going to steal 20 bases this year, likely. He's at 13 now. I don't see it at his age. He's going to be 33 next year. This is why we talk about long term. You know, speed doesn't age well, just because these guys who are speed only. Bourne's a guy who's dealt with hamstring issues. Those really sap your ability to explode and run. They linger. They come back. I mean, this is not a good profile looking at how he's going to age. I don't see it. He's not a guy who hits for a high average. He's never been. He had 1 year where he hit 300, but he's typically a guy who doesn't hit above 280. And, yeah, he just doesn't bring a whole lot to the table. I don't really see it.
Yeah, I completely agree with George. Then it's documented at this point, players like 33, 34 who fall off in speed this way, and even without the injury problems, it's very difficult for a bounce back. There haven't been too many players historically where speed is all or most of their game that have suddenly had that, you know, dead cap bounce that you might see with a power hitter, where they have a year or 2 years, they suddenly hit for power again before they fall off the map. So I'm not really optimistic. I think 20 steals for a full season is probably the best case scenario for Bourne going forward. And it wouldn't surprise me if he morphs into a part-timer. You know, something I was reminded about with all the trade talk with Bourne was, you know, the Mets were being shamed, you know, LOL Mets and all that for not signing him. And you know, he was someone they were supposed to be in play for. And I think it was a 4-year, $48 million deal that Bourne signed, if memory served. And the Mets were kind of chided for being too cheap. But it really looks good right now that they didn't get him.
Yeah, it certainly does.
It's more scary looking at Nick Swisher's decline over the last 2 years, because he's a guy who would hit 25 home runs for like 5 straight years, and then all of a sudden last year just basically stopped hitting altogether, which is freaky.
Well, a lot of that was injuries, and in particular, right, in front of me, a specific injury that, you know, pretty much has hobbled him for like 2 years.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it's something he's probably not going to come back from either. And, you know, even if he bounces back, he just, you're probably looking at a 1 or 2 win player at best.
Yeah, at best.
Yeah. Well, I'm being generous because I like Nick Swisher.
Cool guy.
Yeah.
Bro-hio forever.
Married to Joanna Garcia, too, who is also wonderful.
All right, who else do we have here? NL.
Well, those were the, I mean, those were the two big moves in the NL. You know, as far as the other over $1 bids, there was Brad Hand, who Steve Gardner got, who I wrote about. I'm not really a big fan of Hand. You know, he's going to get the opportunities, and, you know, it's kind of funny. He gets the Cardinals this week, who, if you look at their numbers against lefties, they actually aren't very good, but even in NL only, I don't want Brad Hand against the Cardinals. And then there's David Holmberg, who I'm watching on my TV right now get slapped around by the Padres. So that's life in NL only. You know, people are going to be making these speculations on starting pitchers, and most of them aren't going to work out. It's just the nature of NL only and a lot of these pickups. I wound up taking as a stash off of JJ's recommendation on the stash list. I grabbed Zach Davies for a buck. I have to keep him active this week, and, you know, it's like a lot of these stashes late. Nothing will probably come of it, but for a buck and someone I'll throw in my reserve next week, you know, what the heck? Maybe he has like four or five good starts in September.
I'm like, I don't know how you didn't manage to get a Seinfeld reference in there with the Brad Hand. That seems like something that could have happened. The part where George has hand in the relationship.
In the contest, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's like too easy.
Yeah, and there's no way George would make the Fast Times at Ridgemont High reference. we know that.
Yeah, we know that. George was like -9 when we came out, at least.
I'm a negative war player in terms of references beyond 1980.
Yeah, the winning reference is, I've seen it done before, but the winning Brad Hand reference is the Fast Times at Ridgemont High reference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Is there anybody else, you know, do you guys want to talk about Hand or Holmberg, or is there anybody else in these $1 bids that is worth a mention to you guys?
I think Colin Ray is slightly interesting. I mean, I think we talked about him for a minute before. I don't think he's anything that spectacular. But who got Ray? Because I don't.
It was Phil Hertz.
It was Phil. Okay, yeah. Him and Justin Nicolino.
Yeah, I like Nicolino.
Same idea. I mean, Jose Fernandez. We all love Jose Fernandez. He's not coming back.
Nope.
Well, not ever, but just not this year. I think Nicolino's got a spot the rest of the year, and I think he's okay.
He's command control guy, but that can work in the NL East easily. Like that can play.
Yeah, I like that. Who picked up Nicolino, Mike?
That I have to go look up. I'm not completely sure.
The person who picked up Nicolino reserved Carter Capps, and I always really appreciate it when someone replaces a reliever with a starter and takes a significant strikeout downgrade.
That's about as drastic as you can get. Capps is like 16 per 9.
That's also NL only for you.
Yeah.
Lenny Melnick, which doesn't surprise me. Actually, Lenny picked up Nicolino earlier in the year and dropped him, so he got him back. So he likes Nicolino.
I can't believe Jerome Williams got picked up.
Yeah,
Peter, that's terrifying.
Peter Kreutzer has had. Well, you know, I don't want to get off into two side of a tangent here, but I don't know how much you guys follow Phillies Twitter. They're really excited about the Phillies right now. And I get it. They're playing really well, and it's signs that some of these players are better than we thought. And Michael Franco is better, I think, than some people who were really down on him thought. You know, I know one of the – I think it was Baseball America. No, actually, Baseball America was really high on him. There was – one of the prospect lists was really down on Franco. But, you know, he kind of struggles at every level and then emerges. But overall, you know, the Phillies are still a team that's going to need to add a lot of players to get to where they need to get.
Yeah, at least there's I get it when you go from no optimism to a little optimism. It's
Like, it's okay to be excited about Michael Franco, but Cesar Hernandez, not okay to be excited about. Like,
yeah, you've got
levels of excitement.
You've got Franco and Nola on the active roster in terms of guys I'd be excited about for that next winning Phillies team. Oh, and Giles. You know, those are three guys that I'm excited about on the next winning Phillies team. Like, yeah, everybody else, it's like, okay, well, Obedel Herrera and Cesar Hernandez, but let's not oversell what they are.
Odubel Herrera's batting stance is a nightmare to watch.
Yeah, well, and you know, in Cole's and Havels is no hitter. He had two plays in the outfield where you're kind of like, oh my god, is he going to catch that?
Yeah, at least every night there's a play like that with him.
So that's the NL. I don't know if there's anyone else that we want to touch upon. To move to the mixed. As our listeners know, Brett and I are out of money, so we have no one to bid on. The big guy this week, speaking of the Phillies, was Dom Brown. He went for 11 to Rasball, who's made a bit of a run and is in third place. And they're looking to add home runs primarily because that's where they're low. And as far as guys go to add that are doing well, you know, I just mentioned Phillies are going to be part of the next winning team. Dom Brown's never going to be what I think people thought he would be. But he could be, particularly a deeper mix and L only for fantasy, he could be okay. You know, he could be somebody who hits, let's say, 15 home runs in the course of a season, doesn't kill your batting average. You know, Brett, maybe you don't like him as much as I do, and I don't even like him that much. I just think that's what he could do as a ceiling. Someone in a 15-team mix, I'm like, yeah, that's solid at this point in the year.
Yeah, I want zero part of Dominic Brown.
In 2013, he had 27 home runs. 23 of those were before the All-Star break.
Yeah, he had like a really good month and a half.
Yeah, 16 home runs between May 1st and June 8th.
Yeah.
That year. And then he hit 4 home runs after the All-Star break and has pretty much never been heard from again.
Yeah, I have. Brown is one of those guys that I just don't. Barring a really weird situation, I just don't see myself owning him ever. I'm not buying it. I don't think this continues. I don't think he's a good hitter. I'm not buying it.
Nope.
Okay. The other bids, and there were a few guys in mix that went, you know, over a buck. Luis Severino. I mentioned this in the write-up. You know, I think Ben Carsley wrote him up in the call-up. I pretty much agreed with everything that Ben said. I think he's a solid option. There is kind of that durability factor with Severino where you're not going to expect him to go deep in games, but he's on the Yankees. They have a strong offense, so there's definitely the wins potential there. I don't really know what else I have to add on him. That's it for me. I think he's another guy, you know, good guy in deeper mixed, and someone, if you're playing for wins right now, is about as good as you're going to get.
Yeah, and I think some people view him as sort of a, you know, lightning in a bottle for strikeouts. I don't think that's realistic.
I made that point. You know, I think he's going to kind of be up and down with the strikeouts from outing to outing, and you know, he's not somebody you should be targeting. I think he's a wins guy because of the team and a hopefully do no harm guy in the ratios.
Yep.
And then, you know, you can help me with the pronunciation here. Tommy, what did you say it was? Tommy?
Canely.
Canely, okay.
Canely, like Matt Cain and Cliff Lee.
He's
pretty much a combination of those two guys, right?
he is the Rockies closer.
He's good.
If you had bet on this at the beginning of the year, I probably would have laughed at you. But you know, he's the guy who's going to get the opportunities. And I saw him twice over this past weekend, and he looked good in his first outing. He looked shaky in his second outing against the Nationals, but he got the save. You know, the thing with him is that he got the save in a shaky outing in Washington. If he has a shaky outing in Colorado, it's kind of like, he could be one of those combustible Colorado relievers who blows a couple saves and then disappears. You have to go after saves, so in NL only and deeper mix, you have to pick him up. But, you know the risk. Know that he's still kind of a bottom-of-the-barrel guy.
This is it, the Rockies bullpen situation reminds me of that episode of How I Met Your Mother, where they try to hit all of those New Year's Eve parties.
Oh yeah.
And he's closer number four. It's a revolving door.
That was the episode with fake Moby, right?
Yeah, with fake Moby.
Who's the one in the minor leagues that Colorado has? Is it Diaz or
Jairo Diaz?
Yeah. How long before? I mean, we talk ETAs, but like, how realistic is he in the next year or so?
I think he'll be up next year.
Yeah, I think 2016 is a realistic time frame for him to be, for him to work into high leverage situations.
Yeah. It's tough to speculate on relief pitchers, but he's definitely a guy who kind of fits the mold as a potential closer there.
Yeah, but I mean, speculating on relievers is shitty enough. Speculating on Colorado relievers is just super shitty.
I had to go there, though.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, the only Colorado reliever, like, you can count on one hand in the 20 or so year history of the franchise, the guys that have been really successful for, like, longer than a few months. It just isn't a good place to pick guys up.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It's pretty much just Sean Chacon.
Well, there was Bruce Ruffin had like a 1.5 year period where he was like really good.
Ubaldo Jimenez. That's about it.
There was like a year or two of Rafael Betancourt too before he got old.
Oh, first time, yeah.
Joely Chacin, rest in peace.
What is he in AAA for the Indians now?
I think they released him.
Did they release him?
Yeah.
That's sad.
Oh, I feel bad for the guy. Oh well. Moving on.
It sounds like George has gotten over it.
I had him for too many years in too many leagues. Who else do we have?
Let's see. Yangervis Solarte, who went for five. He also went to Rasball as part of their offensive push. You know, as I mentioned in the piece, you know, he's got the hot hand right now. As a third corner option in a 15-team mix, you know, yet another one of these guys, and this is a theme this week. You know, what we're really looking at with a lot of these pickups, it's mid-August. The September call-ups aren't up yet. The rookies who are going to come up are kind of limited. You know, there aren't too many players left to bid on, which is why guys like Solarte and Brown are being bid on, because you want 7 or 8 weeks worth of stats as opposed to waiting and hoping you get 4 or 5 weeks worth of stats from a stud like Seager. So, you know, Solarte's fine, but he's not going to do much more than he's done to this point.
Agree.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I kind of wanted to ask you guys, the other guys that went over a buck and mixed, Henry Owens went for three and Daniel Norris went for three. So, you know, I mentioned Severino before. I kind of want your opinion. If you, putting the bids aside, if you had to choose between one of these three guys the rest of the season, who are you going for, Severino, Owens, or Norris?
Severino. No question.
Yeah, it's Severino. But I definitely have Norris second on that list. I don't believe in Henry Owens at all. I don't really see it.
The reason why I say no question for Severino doesn't have a whole lot to do with his talent. It has to do with where these teams are. Owens and Norris are not going to last to the end of the season. They're not going to. Boston and Detroit aren't going anywhere. They're not going to push them much into September, I'd imagine. And the Yankees are. And if Severino is good, I could see them actually leaving him in there. And even though I do think Severino will be the best player out of the three of them on a per-start basis, that pushes it a bit more in his direction.
Brett's right. I mean, there's a reason they didn't trade for a starter. It's because they're going to ride Severino the rest of the way.
And I agree with all those points. I think that, you know, it's kind of an interesting debate you're seeing with the other team in New York, with the Mets. I've seen people talk about inning limits for, particularly for Noah Syndergaard, but to some degree for Harvey. And I really have a hard time seeing them put the brakes on these guys when they're in a race. I could see them pitching shorter outings. I could see them, if Steven Matz is healthy, going to a six-man for a couple weeks. I really have a hard time seeing them shut these guys down when they have a shot at the playoffs. And I think the same thing applies to Severino.
Yeah. Yeah. Being in there are a lot of things that matter this time of year when you're looking at trying to figure out what players are going to be most valuable, and knowing where these teams are in the standings and what their tendencies are with young players is all a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. You know, it's why someone I mentioned before, you know, it's why Aaron Nola to me is as solid as he could be. I downgrade him a little bit because I don't know if the Phillies are going to shut him down. But it sounds like they might bring up a couple of the young arms, you know, whether it's Jesse Biddle or, you know, one or two of the guys that they grabbed from the Rangers in the Hamels deal. And they go with either a six-man or they skip guys a couple times, including Nola. You know, and that's something you just have to look at in September. And depending where you are, you're right, Brett. You have to kind of have an eye ahead to that kind of stuff.
A whole lot of Jerome Williams coming.
That's not good for anybody.
The problem is that it could be a whole lot of Sean O'Sullivan coming because he was designated but accepted the assignment back to AAA. So if they really want to save the young arms, he could be back.
That's good news for the hitters in the NL East.
For your 18-team NL only.
Yeah. With a 96-man roster.
Do we have – I think that's it for the mixed, unless you want to touch upon the handful of $1 guys that were taken.
No.
Yeah, I didn't think
no, so. I don't.
I'm good.
AL, there were three guys that went over a buck. The most interesting one to me, and I know he's been a tease like in fantasy for a couple of years, is Abraham Almonte. With the Bourne trade, he should get to play. I don't think he's an example of a guy I don't think much of as a player in real life. But for fantasy, there's just enough there in a mono with a power speed that if he can even hit like 240, I think he could provide a little bit of value. That's a trick, though.
Yeah. Yeah, that's enough said on him. I'm with you on that, but that's a big yawn.
Yeah, I know. It's just when we're talking about mix and opportunities, and we're talking about guys like Solarte and Brown, guys like Almonte are where the opportunity post-trade deadline are in an AL only.
I know. And this is the problem with starting the podcast with the banter on Carlos Correa and Kyle Schwarber.
I know.
We're now at the point of the podcast where we're talking about Abraham Almonte, and I kind of want to throw my head out the window.
George, maybe you can flip the order on
this. I mean, I do have that ability. We'll talk about it later. But
do we want to skip Jose Ramirez and Matt Boyd then, Brett?
Yes.
Please. Yes, please.
How many times is Drew Pomerantz going to get picked up this year? I want to know because
I made this joke in the column. Like between Pomeranz and Gelts and Collins, I feel like these guys get picked up every week or two. And
it's true.
I don't know what people are doing in the AL that they just keep dropping these guys because who are they picking up?
Gene Machi. It's Tozawa. My money's on Tozawa, frankly.
I think he blew the save tonight.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure they both did.
There's your 2015 Red Sox.
They won a World Series like so recently, though.
I know. I'm looking at this. Yeah, I was wrong. Machi did not give up a run. He was scoreless in the eighth. Tozawa gave up a run in the ninth. George, correct me if I'm wrong. You're in Boston. Isn't Tozawa the guy who doesn't want to close?
I think Farrell has kind of, well, maybe not publicly, but I think Farrell's kind of, you know, said, I like to use him as our setup guy. So it's kind of defended him a little bit, sort of shielded him from it. I don't know. They're hesitant to do it. And tonight might be all the ammo they need to go to someone else. Tozawa's a solid reliever. There are few eighth inning guys who are better around the league. Like he's really good. I don't know if he can close. I really don't now.
No, I'm
after seeing tonight, like one outing. Ugh.
Yeah,
he's already blown a save. I don't know.
Yeah, over under on saves the rest of the season for Tozawa, 2.5.
I'll take the over, but it's like 5. I'm at
going
most.
I'm going with the under.
I'm taking the under. Absolutely the under.
He's gonna get 2. I'm looking. By the way, David Buchanan gave up 11 runs in the second inning tonight.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see if I don't think anyone has him in NL Tap, but I'm going to look. nobody has him.
Yeah, that's called pulling a Vin Mazzara.
that's just wow.
That's bad.
I know. Well, somebody, I don't know if you remember, like at the beginning of the year, somebody in Tout bid like 20 or 25 on him.
I remember us talking about it.
It was preseason.
Like, I think it was Brian Walton, and Brian only held on to him for like a week, like a couple weeks, so it wasn't like wasn't like a season-ending move.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely talked about that.
We've entered into a dark and depressing territory. We started out so well. Now,
well, like I said, you know, if you want to stop talking about Fab and, you know, just start having these high-level conversations, I'm glad to do so.
Well, that's, I think, what the next couple months of the podcast is going to look like. If you like this podcast, save for the Fab Talk, you're going to enjoy our first half of the off-season podcasts.
If you like the part of the podcast before we ruined it by talking about Abraham Almonte and David, you're going to love the podcast going forward.
Correct.
If, on the other hand, you want to hear us talk about Abraham Almonte and David Buchanan, you're going to be in for a bad time.
So, anyone else... we have to talk about
it out of Ramirez and Boyd. So yeah, I mean, unless there's one of those $1 guys you want to talk about, no. You know, it's funny. We're going to make this the trade deadline edition of the show, and we barely touch upon that. Were there any trades at the deadline that you wanted to touch upon, Brett or George?
Didn't we talk about the trade deadline already?
We did that last week.
Well, that's right. We're going to talk about the fantasy trade deadline.
Yeah, but we can do that next week.
There's still time.
There's still time.
Yeah, I think a lot of leagues are, you know, I know the expert leagues go until the end of August, beginning of September. And how do your home leagues go? Can you guys still trade in your leagues?
If some of my keeper and dynasty leagues have deadlines that are that either were last week or this week, but pretty much all of my redrafts are end of August.
Yeah. my home leagues are done. The trade deadline's happened already.
Yeah. So, yeah. So let's do it next week. We'll do a big okay. Redraft trade deadline thing.
Well, it's George to distract us with you know, Carlos Correa talk.
Hey, that was good talk, though.
Yep.
This is true. We were all ready to talk about Abraham Almonte for an hour. And then George just walked out like Phoebe Cates.
This is perfect. So I was like, we're going to get the cultural reference in that George would understand, but here we are.
Here we are.
Somehow you've managed to do it. Phoebe Cates.
Now we just need the song to play in the background. It's going to happen. It's taking a little.
Are you looking for the da 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 da?
I know exactly what I'm looking for, and
all right, here we go.
It's coming up at some point. You know, we're just sitting talking about Fab and trade deadlines, and then all of a sudden, you know.
By the way, if Tristan, if you're listening to this like 1 hour and 20 minute thing, I mentioned this to Brett. I have a song that I play every day now as inspiration in Tout Wars, but I'm not going to reveal it until the season ends if I do manage holding on, because you're a monster.
This is true.
Brett, I have you seen another thing George might not know? Have you seen What About Bob, Brett?
What was that?
The movie What About Bob. Are you familiar with that movie?
Yes.
Sorry, Richard Dreyfuss.
Is true.
So I said... Tristan, like last night, and he loved it. I sent him like the 9 second clip of like Bill Murray at the door, like after Dreyfuss kicks him out, and he's like, "Is this some kind of new therapy?" And Dreyfuss flips out. He's like, "You see, he never leaves." That's what competing with Tristan feels like when you're ahead of him in an expert league. It's like, dude, like I was ahead of you by 10 points, and now I'm ahead of you by 2.5. Like, go away.
He's the intimidator. You know he's coming.
Every year.
He's in your rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm. Every year. He still probably has like 3 or 4 moves up his sleeve I haven't even considered yet.
Well, he does have Schwarber, so anything is possible.
Well, Schwarber's the guy that kills me because I mentioned a few weeks ago, I should have just picked him up and carried the dead spot for a month instead of carrying Jose Lobaton. That was just such a mistake.
Hey, we didn't talk about Wellington Castillo.
No.
Who's been on fire and fuego.
Completely.
8 home runs in 12 games, I think it was.
Yeah, he's been good. Very good.
Yeah, not bad for like 29th round pick in labor.
Nope. And the guy who was so bad that we dropped him, and then someone else picked him up, and then they dropped him, and then we picked him back up.
Yeah, and we picked him up. I think my reaction was kind of like, really? Like, do we have to pick him up?
Yeah, but you know we had to.
Did you get the song, Brett?
I did. I was playing it.
I couldn't hear it.
You couldn't hear it?
No.
Oh.
I was very confused. I was like, wait a minute. I was stalling to see if...
Yeah, we were all kind of stalling.
We were stalling. Mike and I were doing a fantastic job.
I think I'm gonna have to go sans microphone to get this to work. Hold on, we're gonna do it.
Okay. Can you hear it now?
Oh yeah, that's good.
That's the song I was thinking of course.
Yep.
We have way more fun than Tino this week.
This is true.
I don't know if it's going to come out. Does it either come out really well? Or...
It sounded pretty good.
I don't know.
I hope it's not for Tino messes where it's like, we think it sounds good, but you edit and you're like, yeah, this is going to be like a 35-minute podcast.
No, this is unfiltered. This is all going to have to go in.
Yeah, it should all go in.
Very little editing that will happen. And that's for you, the listeners.
It's the first time you've heard me curse, too, George.
Oh, that's true. I've heard you curse, just not while we were actually doing the show.
Doing the show, yeah.
I think we've all cursed on this episode, which means it's probably time for us to go to bed.
Good night.
Yeah, are we gonna do our outro, brother?
Yeah, this is the outro. So thank you for listening to episode 64 of Flags Fly Forever. We will see you next week. All right, bye.
Bye, guys.
Good night. Don't send any more ridiculous questions to the bat signal about whether you should trade AJ Ramos and Ben Zobrist for Carlos Correa. Just make up your mind, please. Thank you.
I gotta listen to this one to see how it works out.
What, do you just not listen to them? Like,
oh. I really don't listen to this much now.
It should totally be the intro. I don't listen to us very much.
Yeah, I live it. Like,
that's true.
Well, here's a Brett, you can go if you want. Here's another reference for you, George. So, William Shatner was on a Saturday Night Live in the '80s, where he was at a Star Trek convention, and people were asking him the most obscure questions about Star Trek. Like, you had a safe in this episode. What was the combination? And he's like, I don't know. So finally, he laces into the audience where he's like, guys, like, live your life. He's like, it was a show. I did it for a few years. It's great. I made a lot of money, but it's like, I had a life. Like, you're 35. You know, have you ever kissed a girl? And the guy, like, shakes his head sadly. And he screams at them. And then Phil Hartman is playing the show organizer. They wind up having a fight. And he says, this was the evil Kirk impersonation from The Mirror Within. Everybody claps. But I always think about that being a fantasy expert. It's kind of like, there's a core of people out there. It's like, dude, I love doing this, and it's awesome, and it's great to write about fantasy baseball. But there's a handful of people that send these bat signal questions like, dude, like, there's got to be more.
Yeah. Yep.
Please don't put that in the show. And if you do, that was Evil Mike, episode 20, that nobody will hear, hopefully.
No, no one listens to the show.
No, that's
true. All right.